Join us for Diffusion Digital at diffusion.events, our two-day virtual conference from the 15th to the 16th of September, showcasing leading projects from across Web3 with firesides and panels featuring leaders like Joe Lubin of Ethereum and others from projects including Set Protocol, The Graph, Dapper Labs, Parity, R3 Golem and eToro. Today, I'm really happy to welcome Edward David Burt MP, Premier of Bermuda, our first leader of a country on the show. Edward is pioneering a really exciting fintech initiative out of Bermuda of high relevancy to not just crypto, but Web3. And I think what's really exciting about him as a guest is that he is relatively young and of what I can understand, very high technical literacy and commerciality. So I think the combination of all of those things is indicative of why he's here. And I think a lot of the policy that is being formed out of Bermuda. So welcome to the show, Premier.
Thank you very much, Jamie. It's a pleasure to be on.
So by way of intro, you are Premier of Bermuda, also the leader of the Progressive Labour Party. You are Bermuda's youngest ever Premier, having taken the office at age 38, which really makes me feel like I need to up my game somewhat. And as I said, the reason why I wanted you on the show is because, of course, this is primarily about founders, innovators in this emergent Web3 space, which has lots of stuff packed into it. But of course, probably this industry more than any, its interplay with regulators is of critical importance, especially for these stages, its early stages, as it's trying to find its feet. So Web3, whilst global, has to touch the existing financial system at some point. I know a lot of people like to think that somehow there's going to be this alternative system. The reality is that if it wants to go mainstream, it has to professionalize, it has to engage. And I think the promise of an environment like Bermuda is that it could be one of those gateways, one of those interfaces. So we have had people on the podcast before, Pateras Silgavis of the European Commission, who's setting policy around blockchain and AI and crypto. But I think what's really interesting about Web3 is that there are environments like Bermuda that almost are using their size to their advantage to act more like a startup in the way that larger environments are much more slow moving. They have much greater kind of considerations. So I believe the promise of Bermuda is it could be one of several homes interfaces to Web3. And to be honest with you, I think it's just cool to be able to talk about this kind of stuff with somebody in your position. So again, thank you for coming on the show. So your origins, you attended George Washington University. You did a double major in finance and information systems as a reference, this kind of high technical literacy. And you attained a master's degree in information systems development. At your time at George Washington, you served as president of the Student Association, I guess, foretelling the promise that was there. So did you go straight into politics out of George Washington? And what is the story behind your meteoric rise?
Straight into politics, no. But the story behind my meteoric rise, as you say, can boil down to the fact that I have a tech background. And not very many people were able to, you know, in the late 90s, early 2000s, administer a Perl mailman listserv system, which I managed to bring to the Progressive Labor Party when I joined. I remember it was a initial meeting and they were talking about getting out announcements. And I said, oh, well, I can set up this thing on my web server. And it was just literally, that was my exposure. So I started the listservs and then dealing with the websites and then dealing with campaign technology, et cetera. And that's actually how I got involved in politics. So it was via technology and not necessarily via politics itself, because I've always been into technology from way back in the early 90s. I remember my 486 SX2, my first computer, way back when I bought from Sears. I think, I don't want to say it was a Tandy, but it may have been back then. And just playing various games. And I remember reminiscing with someone the other day about, you know, kids don't know how good they have it. They don't know what it's like editing config sys files and autoexec bats to try to get your games to run. But that's literally how I got into computers.
If we kind of look at that in the context of Web3, I mean, clearly you have hands-on experience of understanding the different technologies and the kind of cycles that, that have come with the web and the internet. At what point did you first hear about cryptocurrencies and begin to develop an understanding for Web3?
That's a great question. Web3 itself is, you know, it's one of those, I don't want to say one of those concepts, but it's one of those concepts that are hard to grasp because it's just so large. It's, you don't want to say how long is a piece of string, but it's one of those particular issues. On the matter of cryptocurrency, however, that although there was the leader of the Progressive Labour Party before me was very big into fintech, it was not something that I had particularly grasped. And I was busy in, you know, an election campaign and other particular items. And what was interesting is that one of the first meetings after I took office, there is a company in Bermuda, Hub Culture, and they were hosting an innovation sprint on the beach here in Bermuda. And they were discussing things surrounding Web 3.0. And so in that particular context was where I got my first exposure. And the proprietor or the leader of that company, Stan Solniker, he had said, oh, well, there are some things that you might know about, and not know about, but the fact is I think that Bermuda is an ideal place for these type of things to grow and to incubate, and it might be something that you get involved in. So from that perspective, that was literally my first understanding, and it was about a week after I had taken office of having that type of exposure, and then there were conversations afterwards, which led us down the road of saying, this is something that makes sense. We can build on our strong history of regulation and to look to expand that to other areas.
Yeah, and that's definitely, so we kind of, before we go into a lot of the initiatives, the new initiatives that you're leading there, I think, you know, to most people, or should we say to the average person, there is perhaps not an appreciation for Bermuda's history in innovating, especially in a financial services context. But I know Bermuda has a long history of leading around reinsurance and as a consequence achieving these kind of high regulatory standards that are now applicable or transferable into other domains. But it'd be great to hear from you a little bit more about Bermuda's history in innovating in financial services.
Absolutely. I mean, Bermuda is the, we call ourselves the world's risk capital. And it's quite incredible that a country as small as ours has so much insurance talent that is here residing in our island. And I happen to think that the evolution has come through what I call Bermuda's Holy Trinity. And that is the relationship between our industry, the regulator, and the government, who all play an equal part in working hand in hand to grow and develop our financial services industry. What is most important is that we have a single financial services regulator, which makes it easy to deal with. And that is basically where we kind of got our start. I don't want to say that it was an issue of regulatory arbitrage because it wasn't. It was just an issue of in insurance in the United States. They had a capacity crisis and dealing with insurance in the United States, you had to go to 50 different state regulators as a state thing, and then possibly dealing at the federal level. Whereas in Bermuda, you could deal with one regulator who understood insurance. And so our pioneering days after there were capacity issues, certainly after Hurricane Andrew back in 1991, and then following the issues of 9/11, and then the hurricane cycles in 2005, were other cycles where it actually demonstrated the fact that we could have speed to market and actually demonstrate the fact that you can set up and establish quickly under a well-respected global regulator. From Bermuda's perspective, it was never an issue of, in some places where it is regulatory arbitrage, where they practice that low level of regulation. That's never been Bermuda's focus. Bermuda has one of the best respected regulators in the world. And by way of example, there's only two countries that enjoy regulatory equivalence with their regulator, with both the United States and the European Union, and that is Bermuda and Switzerland. So we certainly find ourselves at a very high level. And our history for us has been a transparency-focused jurisdiction and not a secrecy-focused jurisdiction. So when there's all these conversations about, you know, who are the beneficial owners of companies, et cetera, Bermuda has had a central register of beneficial ownership for an excess of 70 years. So we know the persons who own our companies here, and we have shared those details willingly with international whether it be law enforcement agents or any government. So our mantra is, what we say about Bermuda is that Bermuda is an excellent place to raise capital, but a very bad place to hide it.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting because, as you say, as innovators in Web3 have tried to navigate often ambiguity rather than anything else, they have been forced into environments and jurisdictions which emphasize privacy. And as a consequence, this has led to large parts of the industry, not by design, becoming very opaque, which has actually hindered its ability to scale, be adopted, and become integrated into the global system. So I can definitely see why kind of your unique value prop is of high relevance there. And again, just for context, so how is policy formed in that context? And it could be applied, let's say, to in a digital currency context. Is there certain frameworks that you have to innovate within? Because I know you have your single regulator, but what kind of frameworks are you required to innovate in?
Well, I think that's a great question, because you said, how is policy developed? And I think that kind of defines the Holy Trinity very well. There's the needs and desires of industry, and there is the needs and desires of the government. So industry will come to the government and outline a broad and basic policy. And we'll say, this is the type of things which we're looking to achieve. And I think that, a perfect example of that happened when we were dealing with our Digital Asset Business Act. It was driven by industry, and these types of conversations of saying, well, if this is something that is a place where Bermuda can play a role globally, came to the government. The government laid out what it was trying to achieve. And then the government, in that policy development process, went to the Bermuda Monetary Authority, our regulator, and saying, this is what we're trying to achieve. How can we work to achieve that? And the Bermuda Monetary Authority, understanding the global regulatory environment, put the, I guess you would say, box around what are the types of things of which we can do to achieve the government's objectives and also to satisfy industry while not completely bowing to what the government and or industry wants, because making sure that they are that strong independent regulator while saying, well, you can do that, but you can't do that. And I think our regulator approaches things from more of a risk-based framework rather than a rules-based framework, where it says we take a look at what it is that you have, and then we can say these are the rules which will apply to this particular circumstance. So it's not one size fits all. But that's kind of our policy development process. So even when there's different changes which need to happen or new, I would say, developments in the market, for instance, we did recent changes to our Digital Asset Business Act to give clarity towards digital asset derivatives, et cetera, those type of things. It goes through that same process where we comes to the government, it goes to the DMA. The DMA will do a consultation to make sure that they are doing what is in line with global regulatory standards. And then we'll go ahead and update and upgrade our rules in that fashion.
Interesting. So I guess it's more principle-based and more iterative. And, you know, in an environment like this, which is so fast moving, that's almost a kind of key requirement. So if we look at the Digital Assets Act, presumably that is the baseline of kind of further initiatives that and we're going to talk about that a little bit later, the Currency Standard Initiative. Could you talk through the Digital Assets Act and, I guess, the kind of definitions around these assets and how you see them within your jurisdiction?
At the very beginning of our Digital Assets Business Act, it was one of the things which I think has been helpful for us, is that we gave a very broad definition of digital assets. We didn't go with a narrow definition, recognizing that it was a very quickly evolving industry. And if you lock yourself into strict legal definitions, then you're certainly going to have a problem in the long term. So we've taken a very broad view of digital assets, and I think that's been helpful in so far as our development and providing clarity to companies globally.
So let's jump into the Currency Standard Initiative, because I think this is really exciting, clearly building upon some of these foundations that you've achieved with the Digital Assets Act and what have you. So could you tell us more about the initiative and I guess what the intent behind it is?
Well, the currency standard, I think, from a broad basis, is trying to enable, I would say, mainstream adoption of the various, I would say, digital assets which are going to exist in the future. And I think if you talk about Web 3.0 in that context, I mean, the future, there's just going to be very many different representations of value. And in history, there have always been representations of value. But the question is, you know, that will enable is certainly there'll be multiple representation value that are going to be easy to go ahead and exchange and to be used for that exchange. And so I guess our view on this is, and I hate to people in Bermuda hear me say this often, where I say that the Japanese skip the age of sail. I did go to military school for a little bit of time as well. And so I did learn a few things, but the Japanese skip the age of sail. And when you look at it from a broader context, it may even be, you know, that Bermuda skips the age of central bank digital currencies, because at the end of the day, that is almost more a centralized concept versus a decentralized concept and what may be there. So the question is, how do we standardize this value transfer, we would say, in a similar way as with email or SMTP standardized email and that type of exchange? And I think it's along those levels. So when we look at currency standard, it's applying this basis of maybe this is not a technology problem. Maybe this is a regulatory problem. And if we use this space on how we can make sure these interactions take place, then we can actually make it easier. And so far as driving mainstream adoption, what we want to do is to attract players to our ecosystem that are already issuing these types of currencies, issuing these types of value, issuing these types of digital assets, and be able to use them in an interchangeable way. The more digital assets that will be, I would say, launched, the more difficult the interchange may be. And if I may give another example, when you talk about SMTP for email, what about the fact that right now we must use multiple different communications devices or communications platforms? So whether it's WebEx, whether it's Zoom, whether it's WhatsApp, whether it's this thing or that thing and all the rest, Signal, Telegram, et cetera. What if you can find a way to make sure that those type of interactions are integrated? So the type of privacy type of stuff you want and the ecosystem that's being closed, you have that, yet you can have that level of interactivity where you don't have to say, oh, let me go ahead and download Zoom or download Telegram or download this so I can talk to you. We can figure out a way to make sure that we have that interchange. So we don't want that type of fragmentation in money. And that is the basis of the currency standard initiative and looking to drive that interaction. So you don't want to, as I said, have an app for each individual piece of money that you use. You want to have a basic standard where that interchange can happen. And the more digital assets that are created and the more that are there, you're going to require that to avoid that level of centralization, I would say.
Yeah, I mean, it's fascinating. And I really like the idea that you're kind of leaping over the top of your central bank issued digital currencies. Because ultimately, if we think about it in a global context or a universal context, because of course, that is the ambition behind many of the initiatives in the Web3 space. I think it's really interesting to think that that standard could come from somewhere like Bermuda rather than necessarily out of the US. And I would imagine could be the thing that could connect up lots of similar jurisdictions.
But here's what's important. And I think this goes along the basis and the line of where we have. I don't think that Bermuda is trying to force that particular standard or develop that particular standard. I think that we want to support private sector technology innovators who want to innovate do this under a regulatory brand that they can use and export to other jurisdictions. And I think that's the key point about it. So we can, as a government, enable certain things. So whether that's enable, you know, the acceptance of digital currency for tax payments or other types of things, that's easy stuff which governments can do. But at a broader level, at this level of interaction, this level of exchange, recognizing that it's something that's going to be necessary for the future, I think it's also important that we don't recognize that technology goes fast and governments can keep up. We want the private sector and those industry players to feel comfortable to advance those things from our jurisdiction and underneath our regulator.
Yeah, really exciting. So I guess sitting beneath that or building on top of the currency standard initiative, and I know this is a work in progress, it's an evolving thing. I think it's currently referred to as an innovation playground. It is taking inspiration from some sandboxes that have been set up from a few different jurisdictions, but extending it one step further. So the idea is that, and I have had personal experience with this with some of the investments that we've made, whilst I think there's good intent behind many of these sandboxes, the stage at which a startup can actually meaningfully engage with them without it becoming actually a burden is prohibitively high. And so I really like this idea that you are, in effect, almost incubating these startups and working with them as they evolve. But could you tell us more about that initiative? And again, I guess when startups would be able to engage with you through it?
You are correct at a broad level. At a broad level, it is certainly difficult to deal with, I would say, the complex regulatory burdens that exist in the global financial system nowadays. And I don't necessarily believe they're getting easier. I think they're becoming more and more stringent. It seems, I hate to quote Napoleon Bonaparte, probably wasn't him, that was one of my, but it was that the bureaucracy expands to meet the needs of the ever-expanding bureaucracy. I think this is true and akin of global financial services regulation, which itself is very difficult, but of which I'm excited about the future promise that Web 3.0 has to make that regulation a lot more efficient. That much being said, it's certainly very complex. As you mentioned, it's a lot of high startup costs, whether it's lawyers, whether it's dealing with those things, to just match the regulatory hurdles. And I'm not entirely certain that's helpful for startups, basically. And so the way in which we look at it is that clearly you want to make sure that, I guess, compliance is part of what you're doing from the very start, but without the burden of having to pay the expense of the compliance at the very beginning, and in order to focus on the actual building and development of your idea. And so I think that this environment is to lower barriers for entry for innovators, lower that particular barrier so that they can work with a regulator very closely and not have to worry about those massive regulatory things up front. It's always at the core of what they're doing and serving a small amount of persons, but dealing with the actual building of the idea and the expansion of the idea at the same time with the regulator so that your compliance is at the core of what you're doing, but you're not building this massive compliance infrastructure, you know, that you might need if you're building and demonstrating this environment for, you know, 20 or 50 people. You don't need to have a compliance infrastructure that is good for a million when you're at that particular level. So it's going to provide, you know, that risk-controlled environment that takes away some of those challenges so that innovators can focus not on making sure they comply with, you know, the regulatory compliance issues, but focus on building and demonstrating their solution and to focus on the real problems of which they're trying to solve.
Yeah, and, you know, we see this time and time again, very early stage projects, just to even to test their idea, even in a sandbox, they need to spend, you know, $1 to $3 million in legal fees to comply with all these things. And they may not even have a use case. So as you say, that burden to innovation, which of course then impacts competition and healthy markets, is dramatically hit.
It's helpful that if you do it in a place like Bermuda, for instance, that you can do that, and then you can, because of the reputation of Bermuda Monetary Authority, if it is successful, then you can, in versus selling an idea to an overseas regulator, you can actually sell them something that is done and completed already, working under a well-respected regulator.
Yeah, and a really interesting export economy for you there, if you're effectively exporting standards and startups. So I guess thinking through some of the challenges to trying to achieve the kind of aspirations that you have there. Obviously, the minute that you start talking about crypto and digital assets and digital currency, people immediately start thinking about the supremacy of the dollar or, you know, other currencies. How do you navigate? I mean, clearly your economy has a very strong relationship to the US dollar on a day-to-day level. And, you know, so to what extent can you innovate in this space without that oversight or burden or interference, I don't know how you would call it, from the US?
I think we've done it successfully in our history, and I think that is just going to continue. We have close relations with the United States and those particular regulators. And I think that what works for Bermuda is that we have a history of being compliant. And so it's not as though we are trying, you know, to circumvent the regulations of which exist. The fact is that we, you know, start doing that, then we put at risk our main industry. And so that's not what we're trying to do. So we're just taking a progressive approach to drive innovation, which is easier for a country like Bermuda to do. And so it's interesting that you'll see when you're dealing with certain things in digital assets that whether it's in hearings on Capitol Hill or others from certain commissioners will praise the approach, the pragmatic approach that Bermuda has taken in digital asset regulation. I think that it works in that. And I think it's complementary because, of course, the U.S. has a fragmented regulatory space. And if you can get products and services or that can work and inside of a regulated, a well-regulated environment, I think that's actually beneficial to the United States and other jurisdictions. So to be respected globally, any company needs to be compliant with the global standards. And that's really where Bermuda finds itself. We recently had our mutual evaluation report from the Financial Action Task Force. Bermuda placed sixth globally out of all the countries that had been, you know, had gone through that evaluation process. So it's certainly the fact that we have this very high standard and we want to make sure that we keep and use that high standard while being progressive in our regulatory environment.
So there have been a number of environments that have very actively marketed, been the blockchain island or various other spaces to kind of attract the industry, as you say, maybe for slightly different reasons. But I guess one of the things that's frustrated some startups, perhaps that are not used to engaging with regulators, is the political cycle. You know, so how startups can have surety that if they develop an engagement with a particular jurisdiction, that that survives any particular one person or even party. How do you go about, I guess, institutionalizing these initiatives so they extend beyond any one political cycle?
That's a great question. And I think that it handles what we do in Bermuda very well. So one of the things is that Bermuda, we have a very intense domestic political system. I would say where there is the battle between my party, which is the Labour Party, which grew out of the workers' movement, and the opposite party, which is the descendant of the party of the merchant class of Bermuda and those persons that had the access to the financial wealth and the beneficiaries of inequalities of the past. So what I would say is that the one place where that politics doesn't necessarily exist so much is in dealing with international financial services, because international financial services is key to our economy and our history. But I think what's broader than that from the aspect of just politics is the fact that that is institutionalized through our financial services regulator, which is independent. So our role in the financial services regulator is just passing laws and putting things under the jurisdiction of that particular body. And the only future risk to that will be the changing of laws that says that you can no longer prove that activity in Bermuda. And that's not going to happen. And the reason why that's not going to happen is because this is our bread and butter, international financial services. And whereas other countries can brag about a lot of different things, it's very strange that we actually brag about the fact that Bermuda is good at regulation. That's something that people want to brag about, but that's where we are. So, I mean, the hype cycle is there. We've been through that. Lots of other countries have been through that. And I think that's why we are so focused on making sure that we lay a platform for real innovation to take place, because it's not going to be the fly-by-nights. It's not going to be the ones that, you know, might be able to market best and all the rest and get flashy things. It's the ones that are able to build solutions that actually solve real-world problems in the world. And clearly, as the focus of your podcast, I think that the solutions that are going to be able to be built on a distributed internet, certainly through Web 3.0, are going to be those tools that are actually going to make the world better. So, I mean, with an independent regulator, certainly, we don't have to worry about institutionalizing what's there. It is there, and that will continue. And the best example of which I can say for that is as the minister who has responsibility for fintech, which is myself as our premier. I know that the system is working when I get a cabinet paper delivered to me for an enhancement of our digital asset ecosystem, which is coming from our regulator, which I did not have hand in. So that means the feedback that they're getting from industry. And that's just the other way that the Holy Trinity can work, where the regulator talks to the industry, they figure out how they can evolve something in a way that it can work, and then bring it to the government to say, we need these laws changed.
So I know that you mentioned privacy earlier, and if you look at your Twitter feeds, I think you've got two. You've got an official one and a personal one. And I've seen you on a couple of occasions tweeting about privacy. I forget what it was in the context of COVID. I can't remember, but it was looking at alternative ways and how a privacy-enhanced approach is kind of preferable, at least to you as a person, presumably, to the country. If we think about some of the innovations that might come out in fintech generally, but of course, the cryptocurrency, I guess, you know, the the most immediate one might be a cashless society. Now, of course, a cashless society can be both dystopic and utopic, depending upon, you know, the intent. So do you subscribe, or how do you subscribe, or which side do you ascribe to when it comes down to privacy? And I guess in that context, are there any considerations that you formed around things like self-sovereign identity and associated data?
Oh, that's a big question, James.
Sorry, I should have broken it up a bit more.
No problem. I'll try to tackle it all. When it comes to the whole issue of a cashless society, it is certainly something that I myself am a proponent of. And I say a proponent of it broadly. But I think that the fears of a cashless society are because of the fact that when, you know, you have persons who will say, oh, it's New World Order, oh, the government can track everything in which you do, et cetera. I think those are based in the real fears, and there's reason for it. Certainly no one wants the government to, you know every single thing of what they've done and what they spent their money on and what they bought their things, which probably happen in Web 2.0, as we can see. So the question is, how do you build something better that actually works for the various applications of which they need to do? And it kind of gets back to when we're talking about, I guess, the currency standard initiative, talking about different types of applications and different types of, you know, value transfer for different situations that all work interchangeably. And so there's different use cases, I guess I would say, for a cashless society or digital money or what the future may be. Like, you may want something that is very traceable. You might be a business that wants to trace that you're, you know, filing your taxes properly and doing those things. Or it may be another particular case where you want to buy a gift for your significant other and you don't want your significant other, you know, poking through your credit card things to spoil the surprise in that particular level. So there's lots of, I would say, different applications for that. But I think that broadly, as we look and as we continue to advance and to innovate, I do not believe that those two, I guess I would say, those things are mutually exclusive. I believe that you can have privacy that can work in a place where persons can have the access of which they need and require, while also making sure that you have enough transparency to prevent bad actors. And I think that's the delicate balance of which we have to straddle. And I think we're getting there. But I think that when you ask the second part of the question about self-sovereign identity, I think that that's an interesting one, because it's a question of what is identity at its core. Identity is not necessarily the passport that you're issued by my government. Identity is who you are and the things and the attributes which flow to you. So I think that the concept of self-sovereign identity is almost matching, you know, the real world. And I think that our approach to this is, as we try to take the approach of many things, is that the identity issue is not necessarily a technology problem, but it can also boil down to a regulatory problem. Because at the end of the day, you just need to trust the people who are issuing credentials or, you know, attesting to certain things. And as long as you can trust that, then you can build that level of identity that an individual person would have. So I think that the approach of which we've taken, we've gone from a place of looking to do things from a national level to doing it in the exact same way as which we're looking at currency standard and others, of saying that there are many private sector players that have built excellent and amazing technology. And the question is, how do you make sure that you have that interoperability between the public sector and the private sector on those particular bases? And I think that's how you drive innovation. Governments are not the best places for innovation to be driven. That's a fact. I mean, you might have large governments that have lots of money that will spend a lot of money to try to drive this, but I think that they will, you know, in a few years, maybe overtaken by things inside the private sector. So I think that smart governments are those that recognize that the private sector can drive these things very quickly, and figuring out how to make sure that there's that interoperability between the public sector and the private sector, while also making sure that you enable people's right to privacy, because I think it's important. And Bermuda has just been a privacy-focused jurisdiction for a while. Being such a small place, you know, we don't want anyone to be in our business. And just as a I would say, a simple aside, celebrities love Bermuda because we ban foreign photographers. So they can have that's just the nature of our country And so I think that it flows well into, you know, how we view the future. I don't want a cashless society where I can track everything of what people do, but I do want a society where value transfer can be done very quickly and efficiently to make sure that we can, you know, make the economy work better and take away some of the inequalities of which have historically happened, where there are, where those levers of control are in a few large players.
Yeah, I mean, I think that context-driven approach and appreciation for the nuance of privacy and identities is exactly why I wanted you on the show. And I think almost impossible to have found in any other equivalent or peer of yours around the world. And I think, if anything, serves as a really great advertisement for Bermuda and a lot of things that you're trying to do there. I'm really grateful for your time. I know there's a lot going on in the world right now. You have many priorities, of which this is only one. So thank you so much for your time.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Jamie, and take care.
If you're an early stage Web3 founder, apply to our award-winning accelerator program, Basecamp at outlierventures.io/Basecamp. We write your first $50,000 check and give you access to 200 mentors, including many of the leading Web3 founders, and a network of 1,000 of the world's leading investors and exchanges. We've helped over 30 startups from 15 countries from all around the world raise $130 million in growth funding and can help you fast track product market fit and, where relevant, the launch of your token economy.